Hey Changemaker, Julia here. This is such an important conversation, and it's one that I would have liked to have again, especially in these times. I'm really happy that you're here and that you'll be listening to this. My guest is Nisha Anand. She is the CEO of Dream.org, a nonprofit organization that brings people together across racial, social, and partisan lines to solve some of the toughest problems in the United States and beyond. She is also the political director of Rebuild the Dream, an organization fighting for an economy that works for everyone. In essence, Nisha works at the intersection of criminal justice reform, green economics, and tech equity to create a better future for all. Nisha has served as chief of staff to Van Jones, the CNN commentator and New York Times bestselling author. Nisha is also a veteran fundraiser and consultant with decades of experience in nonprofit development and management. For over 20 years, she has been a social justice activist and leader. She has seen movements and organizations rise and fall. She uses what she has learned to support leaders, organizers and change makers. So I'm so glad to share this conversation with you. In 1998, Nisha was arrested for her activism, something that we speak more about in this podcast. In our conversation, we really dive deep into the ways that we can have meaningful conversations and social justice movements in a highly polarized world. Nisha shares personal stories of what has shaped her as an activist and into becoming a bridge builder. We recorded this conversation before Hamas' attack on southern Israel and Israel's bombardment of Gaza, which has led to an increasing polarization, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, and more. I would have loved to speak with Nisha about all of this that we're facing right now. That said, I still do believe that this conversation can really help us to connect with the humanity in each other and give us strength to dare to have those really difficult conversations. Nisha says that the humanity that connects us must be stronger than what has been created to divide us. So, without further ado, I'm glad you're joining me for this important conversation. Here is Nisha Anand. Nisha, thank you so much for joining me today on the Hey Changemaker podcast. It is such a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the Hey Changemaker podcast is really about the personal stories of changemakers and the amazing things that they're doing around the world. And it's really people like you that bring us hope in times like these. So I would love for you to just start off by telling a story of when you... a story from your life of when you knew that you just needed to be a part of creating change for others, perhaps when you just felt that you just needed to be a change maker.
Yeah, absolutely. I look back on when I was a young activist in Atlanta, Georgia, in the South. I grew up in the 80s, and Atlanta, Georgia was very much a black and white town, and I was a misfit. My parents are from India. I didn't quite fit in. I got a lot of who are you, or where are you from, or what are you? That question, what are you? Because people couldn't quite tell, am I black or am I white? And being neither made me feel a bit of a misfit. Mm-hmm. And I think that I had two ways to go with that. I could either be a misfit and always feel left out and left behind, which I can tell you many times in my life I have felt that way. Or what I did instead was I tried to be someone that could fit in everywhere. Just being born in the US and being an immigrant child, that first generation American, I was a translator by nature. I was a bridge builder by nature. I had to be the person that, you know, could translate between the old world and the new, explain to my parents how things were, while at the same time holding on to the values that made them who they were and bring them to me. So I feel like growing up in that environment, I got to be a bit of a chameleon and fit in everywhere. Mm. But I also know that I had a strong sense of what was fair and not from a young age. Mm. I didn't want to see anyone else left out and left behind. So I was a young activist before even knowing what that word was, yeah. You know, hating on the bullies, making friends with everybody from every group there was. And one of my earliest change maker moments was in high school. I went to a private Catholic school and I was a young feminist and I decided I wasn't going to shave my legs. And we had uniforms and I would sometimes wear the boys' uniform because I read the dress code really clearly and it didn't say boys wear pants, girls wear skirts. It just said, these are the uniforms. Mm. So sometimes I'd wear the boys' uniform, which I thought was me being, you know, radical. Or other times when I would wear the girls' uniform and didn't shave my legs, of course, I would get a lot of questions, but I liked that. Mm. Until the day I was called into the disciplinarian's office. And she told me that I needed to shave my legs, that it was disgusting. Some of the people, some of the boys at school, and this wasn't Europe, and I needed to shave my legs. And I remember, because I was young, I was captain of the debate team. I had a lot of words, a ton of good words. And I was very much like, you know, righteous in how I felt. And I gave her this long speech about she can take her patriarchal assumptions of what a woman should be and put them somewhere else. And I got detention and we had work details where I had to clean the cafeteria for like 10 days. Mm. I took my punishment fine, but I also started organizing. And so I had all of my other friends, girlfriends at high school, stop shaving their legs too and protest. And I saw the power of organizing. Mm. And, you know, I'm not sure what we did. I found out that the year after I left school, they changed the dress code to include some of these things that I had shown were, you know, that I could exploit and find the loopholes in. Mm. They did change some of them. Whatever impact I made might have gone the wrong way. But I felt the power of change making then. I knew that just my voice and being who I was and being someone who had so many friends and all the different friend groups, I had power there.
Yeah.
And I think that carried me through the rest of my career for sure.
Nisha, thank you so much for sharing that story. Wow. I mean, it's really a story of solidarity and sisterhood and all the amazing aspects of activism at a young age. That's fantastic. And you've had a career within media and the nonprofit sector for a long time. What brought you to becoming an entrepreneur as well?
Wow. So I have had I feel like now my career, I can look back, I've been every part of the change-making world, whether it's direct organizing, like with the, you know, in the high school, or I did a lot of activism on campus and college. Mm. I did a lot of international human rights activism. I certainly spoke with diplomats and legislators. I did a lot of change making. And when my kids were little, when I had kids, and so now we're skipping like decades ahead, I was at home and I was just helping other organizations, NGOs fundraise as a consultant while my kids were young. Mm. And I missed the work environment. I missed being full-time doing the work, but I knew I didn't want to go back and do the same thing I had been doing.
Yeah.
So I did a really deep search, which a lot of new moms do. You kind of lose yourself. You don't know who you are. What am I in the world? And I knew that I was always meant to live this life of change-making, of consequence, of wanting to do right and make the world a better place. Mm. And I wanted to do it at a bigger scale.
Yeah.
And so when I went back to work, when I was ready to go back to work, I looked at what can I do at a bigger scale? How can I play a bigger game? Mm. And I wrote down a few names of organizations and people that I saw out there in the world doing big things. Mm. And one of the names was Van Jones, who's a US activist. He's on CNN and, you know, worked in the Obama administration. But from my young days, he was just an activist on the street with me. Mm. We went to the same protests. We did the same things. And he was playing a bigger game.
Yeah.
And so I got a job description. I applied. I got the job. It's been 10 years. Mm. And I have been CEO at Dream.org for the last 4.
Mm.
I can tell you when you say what made me be an entrepreneur, it's hard for me to describe myself that way.
Mm.
But I can say in the last 10 years, I have made more change. I feel like I have been able to create better outcomes for so many people by using a different model of activism and organizing than I had in the past. Mm. I feel like right now I'm in my sweet spot. And in the US context, if you are ahead of a nonprofit, there's only so much you can do to make change. And legislation is one of the big ones.
Mm.
If you can change one law, sometimes that can change the entire society. And 5 years ago, we helped pass this piece of legislation called the First Step Act, a criminal justice reform bill. And since that day, 30,000 people have returned home from prison. So for me, impact is how I decided what I want to do at this point in my life. And nothing has had more impact than this model at dream.org that we work with. And it is entrepreneurial in that we're willing to do things no one else will do. And it's not always liked. And people don't always understand why you're moving the way you're moving. To get that piece of legislation passed, we needed a vote in a Republican-controlled House, Senate. There was a Republican President Trump at the time. And we got 89 out of 100 senators to vote yes on the First Step Act. That's not just a little bipartisanship. That's a lot. And at the end of the day, we needed to have Trump sign that bill. That was not well liked in the U.S. either. But for me, the people inside prison do not care who was in the White House. They wanted that bill signed so they could get back to their house. And that's how we played it. And it's not always well liked. And so as an entrepreneur, we're always looking for the next thing and how to innovate and willing to do these things that aren't typical. And I have a lot of stories about that, but I feel like I've been talking for a long time.
I feel like there are so many angles here that we're going to get into during this conversation. But I would love to take a step back for you to just share a little bit more about the mission of Dream.org and the organization that you run. Because there are different aspects to it, and I would just love for you to just dig a little bit deeper into what you do.
Sure. So Dream.org, our mission statement is closing prison doors and opening doors of opportunity. And we took the two biggest problem sets that we could think of in the U.S., criminal justice reform and climate. And we thought, if we can make change on these two big issues using our model, we can do it anywhere. And so our model is really, we're a progressive organization that wants to see changes in the criminal justice system and wants to see us really tackle climate change and make a difference on the planet. But we will not choose any campaign, any program, any product. We won't support any business people that's going to further division in the U.S. We believe in progress without polarization. So everything we do has this element of unlikely allies, misfits like me, right? How do we get the strangest pairings of people at the table? Because it's the right thing to do. That's how democracy works. You need diverse voices, but also it is the most durable and probably the only thing that works. If you have a solution where everyone has come together with, it doesn't get overturned easily. You've built a lot of power by bringing such diverse people together. You've also shown the world you can work together. And right now there's a really, like, in our souls, there's this disbelief that it's possible. But I'm living proof, and Dream.org is living proof, that you can take big problems, bring people together, and actually forward solutions that can make the world better for all of us.
And you have a TED Talk that has been viewed over a million times, where you talk about the radical act of choosing common ground. And this is really, you know, what is a part of everything that you do at Dream. So in times like these, when we are seeing such increasing polarization, and it's not only in the U.S., I mean, in my country here in Sweden, we're seeing that for sure. And especially after the latest election, I feel like we're having a little bit of what the U.S. had when Trump was elected. How do we come together? What advice do you have in terms of how we can actually find that common ground without falling into like a political divide or focusing on the things that actually keep us apart?
It's not easy, especially when it comes to your own personal life. You can think of that person in your life you disagree with, and finding common ground with them can sometimes be hard. But I can tell you, my father, who is a Republican, voted for Trump twice. We don't agree on almost any political issue. We still know how to plan a trip together. If we order a pizza, we know how to order one, right? If I'm vegetarian and you're non-veg, we can absolutely come together and figure out how to order a pizza, we split it in half, we go veg, we order two pizzas. We know how to find common ground. We just don't think about applying it to politics because we become so tribal and gone into our areas. I think the most important tip that I give anyone is being curious. We know how important it is. Most people on this planet, and certainly most people you come into contact with, nearly everyone we come into contact with, wants to live on a safe planet. They want to breathe good air. They want to provide for their families. We have this in common. So the fact that we diverge on how we get there or our opinions of what we need to fix doesn't change that there is some common ground there. People don't come to the table and say, well, I'm pure evil and you're pure good. Now let's talk. They come to the table with both of us knowing we have good to do and we want to do good. And so I say, be curious and find the people who are going to find the win-win outcome for everyone. It's not easy, for sure. And democracy is fragile.
Yeah.
It's really fragile and it's very precious. When I was a young college activist, I, like I said, I was involved in any group that wanted to make change. And one of them in my university was the Free Burma Coalition. They were very active. Burma being a military dictatorship, now referred to as Myanmar. They were very active. They had had a long-standing pro-democracy movement for as long as it's been a military dictatorship. And in 1988, there was a student uprising. It was on the day of 8-8-88. And students who were pro-democracy were protesting the fact that an election had just happened. The National League for Democracy had overwhelmingly won, but the military junta cracked down and wouldn't acknowledge those results. And so this uprising, about 10,000 people were killed. Other students fled to the border regions or fled the country and lived in exile. And I was in college, or I had just finished college in 1998, and the Free Burma Coalition was arranging a trip to Thailand for the 10-year anniversary to learn from the border what's going on, what we can do now, how could we be helpful. And I joined a group of protesters from around the world. There were 18 international activists from many different countries who went in on that 10-year anniversary. So on 8-8-98, we went in and we handed out these small postcards that said, "We are your friends from around the world. We support your hopes for human rights and democracy." We had to smuggle them in our shoes. We had to, we hid them in like our bathroom bags, but we got them into the country and we handed them out on that morning. And it was a well-planned action. We were supposed to hand them out, get in a cab, get to the airport, get back to Thailand. And all of us got arrested. I didn't know, we were in groups of three with our people from our own countries, and I didn't know who else had been arrested, but my group of three had been arrested. And I spent a week in jail. On the, like on the seventh day or eighth day, we got whisked away to a sham trial. That's when we discovered all 18 of us had been arrested. And we were sentenced to 5 years of hard labor for handing out this small business card size message. We're your friends from around the world. I didn't serve the 5 years. We were deported the next day. But I saw firsthand, because in the US, you don't really see it. And certainly at that point, I didn't understand how fragile democracy was. But I saw what these authoritarian strongmen, anti-democratic, or in the case of Myanmar, you have a military junta who's obsessed with astrology and anti-democratic, what that can do to a country, to a people for a lifetime. And I never, ever thought that would happen here. But I can tell you, with the last election we had in the US, when we had something of a coup trying to overturn the results of an election, one of our generals, Michael Flynn, was giving a speech, and Myanmar had also just had an election. That the Democratic Party had won, the junta took over again. And someone asked this high up US official, they said, "Hey, how come what just happened in Myanmar, why can't that happen here?" And Michael Flynn, U.S. representative, said, "I don't know. Maybe it should happen here. Actually, it should happen here," was his response. And it was a full circle moment for me, because I was willing to risk my life to save democracy in Myanmar. And I really could have died in that moment, for sure. And to see that happening now, and with the rise of authoritarianism around the world, I feel like we have to model how beautiful democracy can be when it works well.
Yeah.
And that's what we do at dream.org. Mm. That was a long way.
Yeah. Well, I had that story about Burma and Myanmar in my question. So I'm really glad you got to that, because I think that it just gives such a good perspective. Thank you for painting that picture of how vulnerable we all are, and how important we all are in actually standing up for democracy and protecting the rights that we have. So Dream.org also has a new Justice Innovation Prize. I would love for you to just talk a little bit about that and how, and then also I would love for you to speak a bit more about how you're working with people who have been in prison, and how, what the model actually looks like at Dream.
So in the US, we have, like, I don't have all the statistics right, but we have something like 3% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prisoners in the US. We have an over-incarceration problem.
Yeah.
We lock people up for everything in this country, and I'm not exaggerating. Since we passed this crime bill in 1994, we've seen like a 500% rise in people who are incarcerated. It's like that old saying, if the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Mm. The only tool we seem to have in the US was prisons. And so we locked a ton of people up for nonviolent offenses, drug offenses. A lot of people still in prison for marijuana, which is now legal in most of the country, are still sitting in prison. And our prisons are dungeons.
Yeah.
There is not, if for the most part, there are exceptions, but for the most part, if you tour any prison in the US, you're going to see desolate places with very little programs for rehabilitation, very little investment in redemption, restorative processes, addiction, skill building. That doesn't really exist in most of our prisons. Yeah. And so about 90% of the people who are incarcerated, they're going to come home one day. Our problem has been, with this large incarcerated population, they're coming home worse than when they went in.
Yeah.
So we have a problem. And one of the other problems is that that's US taxpayer dollars that are going in to fund this system that has bad results. If you look at any other business, if you said, give me all of this money and we're only going to grow, we're only going to incarcerate more and more people because we're actually not rehabilitating anyone. It's bizarre. So the incentive is wrong.
Yeah.
Wardens get more taxpayer dollars, more money, the more people they lock up. So it's not helping our society at all. We do a lot of legislation at dream.org. We are trying to pass a lot of reform bills, and some of them have been wildly successful. Women were shackled in childbirth in prison. They still are in some states. Mm. So passing bills that change that, our Dignity for Incarcerated Women bills, they're critical. They are important.
Yeah.
But what we realized last year was that that is never going to go far enough. We will still keep working on the reform bills. They're necessary. And I have an entire team that is just amazing at doing that. Mm. But we wanted to look at, how can we completely disrupt this system? How can we change it so that we're not looking at dungeons as the only tool when there is some crime or some harm? What are all the other tools out there?
Yeah.
And our proximity to Silicon Valley made us immediately look at tech. Mm. Tech startups love to disrupt dysfunctional systems and improve them. And we wanted to ask, what are the ideas out there that could completely transform? So yes, we will be reforming the system, but what's out there that could transform it? Mm. Is there something else we could do that completely flips this model on its head? And so right now we have a $1 million prize for the best ideas out there, tech-enabled solutions that could disrupt the criminal justice system and this whole mass incarceration industry. And we had a ton of applicants, obviously. We had a great panel of judges that narrowed it down, and we have 5 finalists that will be taking the stage in October to pitch their ideas at SOCAP, which is a social impact investing conference that happens in the Bay Area, and we'll be awarding the prize to the best in the industry. We hope that doing this will seed the field, because it isn't really a field yet. justice innovation it should be.
Yeah.
And so we really want to get this field started so that we can really get alternatives out there and hopefully make some major changes to the way we think about punishment and rehabilitation. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so curious about the five finalists. Do you have like a little spiel for each that you can share?
Folks can look them up at dream.org for sure. And there should be something that takes you to the five finalists or the justiceinnovationprize.org. But we have ideas and we really wanted to look at, we said anything that can improve outcomes in incarceration. So we have one that really is geared towards education and training inside. That could be scaled so it's not as dependent on a human body, but what's a tech-enabled solution that could work on rehabilitation. We have a universal basic income proposal out there for when folks come back from prison. What if we just gave them money? And because one of the hardest things, one of the biggest problems when folks come out, there's no pathway to a job. And in fact, you can't get a job in some places if you have a felony conviction. And so how do we just give them a great place to land? So experimenting with that. We have another one that was fascinating about investing. And right now, if you invest your money, you can tell your wealth manager, hey, I don't want to invest in companies that are hurting the planet.
Yeah.
Could we also make a whole idea out there for ones that aren't profiting off of incarceration, but in fact are thinking about how to decarcerate? What are those businesses? So those are some of the ideas out there that I think are important and could influence the field. But hopefully we'll be able to experiment on a much bigger scale soon and see if we could completely transform a prison somewhere to have a different outcome that could. We're really excited about what's possible. Oh, this is just the beginning.
Yeah, I'm really curious and I'll be following that. That sounds, I mean, incredible to see what kind of solutions come out. Yeah.
And one thing that's really important about this is that most of these ideas come from formerly incarcerated people. The ones closest to the problem are going to have the ideas that make a big difference. And so of our applicants, I think we had something around 80% were formerly incarcerated individuals or were linked to people who've been formerly incarcerated individuals. There was over 70% were women-led businesses. And we know in Silicon Valley, these are not the people who are invested in. The numbers are so bleak in terms of where venture capital dollars go. Yeah. And so we thought as a nonprofit, could we shine a spotlight on how brilliant these ideas are for not just changing the world, but they're also good business ideas.
This is incredibly interesting. And I think that the whole idea of including people who are actually, the best to come with solutions for these problems. I think here in Sweden, there is a current conversation and debate and a lot of political resources are going towards the problems with gangs and criminality. And a lot of it is leading to, harsher punishments and getting younger people into prisons and, all of that. That's the way the Swedish government right now is speaking about taking a harder stance and becoming, tougher with crime. And very little of the conversation includes those who live in the areas that are affected, that have seen, who's a part of this problem. And I think this just points to that. And I think it's really so important and something that we can see across, countries and regions in the world, that we can see the similar problems when somebody that's away from the problem and not connected is trying to come with solutions.
Totally. Tough on crime does not work. We have no statistics that show locking up people for some of these, especially like property crimes, has made communities safer or made crimes go down. It doesn't. Yeah. It doesn't work. And I think that community voices and community solutions, it breaks my heart to hear that they're not included in the conversation. I mean, if you follow the U.S. down the path of over-incarcerating, you're going to have an over-incarceration problem versus what we're trying to do now is some diversion programs. And it costs the US about $70,000 per person to lock someone up. I promise you, in a neighborhood high crime, if you offer them the same amount of money and say, help us solve crime in this neighborhood for that amount of money per person, they will come up with much better solutions. Yeah. They absolutely will.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I love that. And I think that it just brings us back to the humanity and the connection we all have with each other, and really that radical act of choosing common ground that you speak about. And I feel like there's so much hope in this conversation, but I'm sure that you also, you know, with all of the work that you do, also face a lot of challenges and, you know, people who might not be interested in finding common ground and, you know, people who don't want to collaborate. So how do you work when it sort of stops there, when people, you know, aren't willing? How do you navigate those situations?
Well, I think, you know, first, you find the people willing to collaborate is probably the most important part. There are going to be people who don't want to collaborate. They're also going to be really loud. They're mm-hmm. the ones that are going to call you names and shame you on social media. And that's part of the world we live on right now, the world that we live in right now. And I just look at something like the First Step Act, where everyone told us, don't do it. Don't work with Republicans. This law isn't going far enough. You're selling yourself out. Whatever the accusation was, I can look at the 30,000 people who've come home and said, no, we did the right thing. Mm. And I think at the end of the day, that's what you have to live with, is what are you doing this for? Are you doing it to win points on social media? Because that's easy. Mm. I can just get on social media right now and talk, you know, just drag a bunch of people or shame a bunch of people who I think are doing the wrong thing. Mm. That's easy. I'll get a lot more likes than I get now, for sure. That's the easy thing to do. Mm. I think the harder thing to do is explain where you might be having some confusion. Yeah. Explain the places where you've changed your mind. Mm. Explain the ideas that aren't just black or white issues, where there is some in between. Because right now, no one wants to admit there's in between, but there is always in between. Mm. One of the things I do in a conversation, like when COVID first hit, and we all started wearing masks, there slowly became, and I don't know if this was the case in Sweden, but certainly in the US, it became a political issue and it became a divisive issue. And there were a ton of people out there who were like, I'm not gonna wear a mask. And then there were a ton of people out there who were like, you must wear a mask everywhere all the time. You have to protect your people. I wore a mask, I was kind of on that side. But one of the things in this conversation, my son was on a baseball team at the time that was with folks who were very different than me, because we weren't allowed to play baseball anymore in California. They shut down all of the baseball fields, and my son was a pitcher and he had to throw. So we joined this team who didn't care about the rules, which meant a lot of them were Republicans. Many of them were anti-mask, anti-vax. And this is how I spent my COVID years, was with a team very different than me. And in one of the discussions around masks, someone said, you know, I'm like, hey, you know, why aren't you wearing them? This in the early days. It was like, you know, I don't want my kids to have to wear them because they're getting these pimples and their face is getting, you know, gross and they're losing their confidence. And, you know, I don't like it. Well, I can admit that that's true. Mm. Yes. Masks do give the kids more pimples. They are losing confidence. It does suck. Mm. It is hard for them to do their normal things. Mm. I can admit that that's true, while still saying, but here's why I am wearing a mask. The problem is we get in these conversations where we couldn't even acknowledge that.
Yeah.
So in these difficult conversations, I tell people, always find a place where you can agree. It is there. Mm-hmm. It is somewhere. It doesn't have to be with the whole thing, but you can say, yeah, masks do suck. You're right. I can't breathe. Mm. Find that place of agreement and find it as much as you can, because that moves the conversation forward. Otherwise, you know, we're just lying to ourselves too. Mm. There are places of agreement. You can find that common ground. And just right now, no one even wants to admit that.
Yeah. Nisha, I really appreciate this conversation and I'm really taking it all in, just feeling like this is such great personal advice for me as well. Because there are, you know, there are difficult conversations to be had and it's easy to avoid them, which doesn't help the problem. It doesn't help us move forward. Yeah. And you mentioned in the beginning that you also have, you know, these situations even within your family. So how do you sort of, it must be incredibly difficult when it's something that is really close to your heart or something that you feel very strongly about. And working with a lot of feminist activists from around the world, you know, many of these issues can have a direct impact on our own bodies or our own sort of sense of self. So yeah. how do you sort of find that source of, you know, of love to fuel your work for common ground, but not only your work, but for your conversations with, you know, the intimate conversations with the people that you love? How do you, and when would there be sort of when would it be time to set a boundary where, like, because sometimes we can't accept everything. Right. And we need to protect ourselves, too. So how does that work for you?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that we have to set the boundaries. And I would never tell anybody to enter into one of these difficult conversations or try to find common ground if they're not physically safe, or even if it causes a reaction that's going to make you not safe mentally or in your own health. Mm. Don't do it.
Yeah.
And not all of these hard conversations are meant for everybody. But I think if you're at a place where you are in a healthy state and you can engage in these, you have to. Because I have access to my family and my parents who might think differently, it is my duty to try to talk to them about seeing the humanity in all people where they might be judgmental. I need to go and do that work. It's my work to do. If I ever felt, and I would tell anyone else, if you feel physically unsafe, don't do that work. But I want to challenge us to have those hard conversations, because if not us, who will? Mm-hmm. So although I want everyone to be physically safe, I don't want, I'm not one of these safe spaces people where you have to be completely mentally safe. You actually have to be challenged. You have to have these hard conversations. Yeah. You have to engage in, you know, challenging your own thinking and challenging other people's thinkings. You don't get strong going to the gym lifting the light weights. And that's what we do right now. We only want to go into conversations where people agree with us and we can just make, you know, a few smart points, you know, and just lift these light weights. But we will not be able to change hearts and minds and kind of grow this value of love if we don't have the harder conversations. We need to get stronger by lifting those heavy weights. And so I grew up in a family that loves to talk politics. My father would love to sit around the table and debate everything. Mm. And my husband can tell you that at least for a good 10 or 15 years, there was not a single conversation my dad and I would get in where it didn't lead to me yelling and getting mad and saying he's not listening or whatever. Mm. But at some point when I transformed a little bit to have these conversations and say where he's right and point out places where we agree, the conversations go so much farther now. Mm. I very rarely now yell and scream and storm off. I'm sure my husband will tell you I still do it sometimes, but it's completely transformed.
Yeah.
And we can have bigger, longer conversations. And that's important because other people can't. So yes, protect yourself and challenge yourself. Mm. Both things can be true. And you have to know where you're at in your life to know which ones to do. Mm.
So inspiring. And what would you say is sort of the fuel for you? I mean, how do you sort of care for yourself in all of this and to fuel yourself to have face these challenges? I'm sure that it gets easier, but you're also taking on bigger and bigger challenges. So sort of what helps you with this work?
Yeah. Well, I'm an optimist, if you can't tell that by now. I run on a lot of hope and love in general, but I also don't think I'm a naive optimist. I feel like I'm a determined optimist because I have seen enough change in my lifetime to know it's possible. Mm-hmm. And I've done the work so that if I'm doing the work today, I'm changing the future. And that's why I think my optimism is based in reality, is that if we do the work today, we're creating different outcomes for the future. Mm. I've seen so many issues change in my lifetime in the US around gay marriage, complete switch. around incarceration was not a bipartisan issue when I started this work. And now to see so many people coming to the table, I just have enough proof points to know that if you put in the work now, it's going to do so. So I have a lot of belief in myself. I have a lot of belief in my team here at dream.org, but I'm a mother too. I have to believe in their ability to live in this world and change this world and give them the tools to persevere and see that they can change the future. And so I do think of that also as an act of hope. I can't think of any other way of living. In terms of how I take care of myself, I mean, it's just that remembering that things have changed, that I've witnessed it, and that I'd rather love the rest of my life and love people I don't quite understand than hate them. I'm not going to let their hate change who I am inside. It's just my choice. It's a better way to live. And you can make whatever choice you want. You can wake up every day full of hate and want to, you know, shame everyone who doesn't agree like you. It's just not for me.
Oh, I love that. I love that. And it also brings me to think about how easy it is for us to put people into boxes and categorize people. And that's sort of how our brains work. I mean, when we teach our small children what a cow is and what a horse is, you know, we group things. That's how our brains work. But I think that you're really just challenging all of us to not do that and to see people as people ourselves and see the humanity and really mirror ourselves in each other. And that really can't be done without love.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you just know, like, think about how many categories you are.
Yeah.
Yourself, right? Like, all of us are full of these dimensions. So many different parts of who we are just exist. That's true for everyone we meet. Get curious, get to know those parts of other people too.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Nisha. This is a podcast episode full of hope, and I'm really encouraged by the work that you do, and I'm so happy that you could share it with me and with changemakers around the world today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining me in this conversation with Nisha. If you want to know more about her work, you can find out more at nishaanand.org and at dream.org. All the links are in the show notes. Also, since we spoke, the Justice Innovation Prize that she talked about has been awarded. The three winners, each receiving $300,000, were Unlocked Labs, working to strengthen opportunities for incarcerated learners, Justice Text, that aims to improve criminal justice outcomes for low-income defendants, and FreeCap Financial Inc. that has created FREE, an index that makes it possible to invest in companies who lead in fair chance hiring and disrupt the prison industrial complex. Since I spoke with Nisha, I've had to take on challenging conversations, and the words that she shared in this podcast has been in the back of my head, and in one instance, I've also needed to set boundaries and taken myself out of conversations that haven't been healthy or productive in any way. I hope that this conversation has given you hope and at the same time can offer a sense of self-respect and shared humanity as we strengthen our various movements working for positive change around the world. Thank you for being here. And please, if you have a comment, question, or any input from this conversation or others, please go to girlsglobe.org/changemaker and leave me a voice note or write a comment on this episode. And lastly, but not least, if you enjoyed this episode of Hey Changemaker, please consider following the podcast in your favorite podcast app. Leave a review and share it with a friend or someone you know who may be encouraged by it. Thank you so much, Changemaker.